Welcome on back to another episode of Culinary Road. Your host, Justin Melnick, alongside Fred Mullins, as always, my great friend, Fred. What's going on, Fred?
How are you doing? Good to be back.
Yeah, I'm doing good. So today we have sort of the guest that everyone's been talking about all the way leading up until this podcast.
Every episode.
Lorenzo Savona. So Lorenzo, obviously not everybody knows who Lorenzo is, but his name has been mentioned in almost every podcast leading up to this. Mm-hmm. And there's a great reason behind that. Lorenzo is sort of a little bit of the godfather to all the people that we've talked to and to us as well. So when I first got out of culinary school, I went to the Culinary Institute of America, and my first job out of culinary school was actually at Tommaso Trattoria, which I think I was 21, 22 years old at the time. I eventually ended up taking over as the executive chef, but I came on as a garde-manger line cook at 20, you know, again, 22 years old. And I remember, and Fred, I don't think you were actually at Tommaso when I started. I think you had moved back down to Florida and you hadn't come back yet.
So. Yeah, I left to go work on a couple of different projects. I opened it, was there for about a year. And then I'd opened so many restaurants. Lorenzo and I did a lot of work together. I got a little burned out and decided to step away from it for a little bit, then realized about a year later I liked it too much. But yeah, I think we kind of crossed paths like maybe 2 weeks apart.
Yeah. Speaking of the Godfather, you know, once you're out, they pull you back in, right?
Yeah, a little bit. Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. You can't get away.
But I remember one of my first memories of Lorenzo was he used to do these wine classes for the staff, for the front of the house staff. And mm-hmm. he'd discuss, you know, whatever wine they brought in that week, whatever was on the wine list, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's pretty standard stuff, but you know, I was in the kitchen. So I was working garde-manger or salad station at the time. And I remember Lorenzo walked by and I said in the little bit of Italian that I knew at the time. And, you know, I probably know less now than I did then, but
it's funny how it works, right?
Right. Exactly. I said, Lorenzo, perché non classi di vino per me, which is a poor translation of how come there's no wine class for me, which as a 22-year-old kid really meant how come I can't drink?
I'm at work. I should be allowed to drink.
Right. So, you know, Lorenzo at that point realized that there was a little bit of an interest that I had in wine and or in learning just about the culinary road in general. And so he sort of took me under his wing a little bit from a culinary standpoint. I was more focused on the kitchen, but he would always make sure at that point that I started tasting things. He would bring me a little taste of, you know, a Chianti or a Nero d'Avola or whatever. And just so I could understand the different nuances and the different terroir and the different changes between the regions throughout Italy. And you know, obviously it was an Italian restaurant, so it was Italian centric, but that was really the jumping off point where I realized that, you know, wine does not have to be complicated. It's not this thing that has to be overly thought about or, you know, it's really just, do you like this? Great, drink it. Do you not like it? Okay, why don't you like it? Okay, then don't drink it. And I mean, it really is as simple as that. But Lorenzo was the first person that really got me realizing that wine is not this big beast that you can't conquer. It's really, yeah, it's really just part of the food world, the culinary road.
Yeah, he's like that with everybody. I can't, you know, he took me under his wing. You know, I said it on a different podcast, a colleague of ours, which we interviewed, you know, he trained me, but, you know, we worked together and we were kind of learning together. But Lorenzo, you know, I remember one specific night, they kind of doubled the size of the restaurant. This is Les Zigamot, the French bistro that he opened with a partner. And we called it the jazz side because we had live jazz over there. And at the time, that was the smoking side of the restaurant. So this is going back a ways. You can't do that.
Right.
but that side had been open for a couple of days. And there was a bit of an issue with the fire alarm. Fire alarm went off for no reason. There was nothing wrong, but it went off. But it's Saturday night. I think it was like 8:30 or something, like right in the crux of just being as busy as you could possibly be. And the fire marshal came in. I mean, just shut us down. We had tons of, you know, orders in the window, bottles of wine open everywhere, drinks sitting on the bar, and we just had to stop on a dime. So, you know, the fire marshal's there, kind of looks through it and everything. All the customers had to leave. It took like an hour to sort it all out. We're all kind of, you know, we're kind of tired, you know, looking forward to having a really busy Saturday night, which we had. It was ripped out from underneath our feet. And Lorenzo's like, well, we should just eat and drink. What else are we going to do? We're all kind of like, yeah, it was a great idea. So we were all sitting around, and that's when I had my moment. And I talked about this with Andrew Bishop, which is a different episode, but I'm like, yeah, I'm with my people. So that was sort of my wine moment. But the real moment that night was, as Lorenzo came over with a bottle of Palo Bayo Sagrantino. I had no idea what that was. And I was really into French wine at that time. And he poured it for me. And I'm going to be really blunt. I mean, we talked about it with such, he was enamored with the wine. So I was already intrigued before he poured it, but he poured it and I tasted it. And he probably influenced my opinion to some extent, but it was like a bomb, like, went off on my palate. It was like, I literally said, after I took the first sip, is, holy shit, wine tastes like this? And then we had an hour discussion about that grape, Umbria, which is the region it comes from. And we talked about all kinds of things, you know, books. He used to be an encyclopedia salesman, which is
right. Like this.
You know, I mean, who is that? Of course, Lorenzo did that. But we talked about everything, him doing that. We talked about music. We talked about travel. And it was just, it was such a vibrant conversation. It changed everything for me. I felt like, you know, like I was his friend, you know, and I'd only been there for like a month, maybe 2 months at that point. And it was just, was such a great experience. And he treats everybody like that. And I think that's why he was such a good mentor, a luminary, a leader in the field, however you want to refer to it. That's why there's such an appreciation for him, why he's still relevant, why he matters so much. It wasn't really like that back then. And I mean, and you've worked in a few different restaurants, you know, that there's the back of the house in front of the house thing. And Lorenzo didn't let that exist. He tried not to let that exist. We're all working together. This is food and wine. It's together. So be together. And I thought, you know, that's has always been his approach. And that was, it was a revelation.
Yeah, I've absolutely adopted that approach in my last couple of restaurants, and 100% at Spello. That's the thing that we talk about all the time. There is no divide between the front of the house and the back of the house. We're all one team working together. It's the hospitality industry. Yep.
Exactly.
And, you know, that all comes back from Lorenzo sort of teaching me that, you know, that 22-year-old kid out of a culinary school just trying to get an extra glass of wine before service starts.
But didn't it mean the world to you?
No, like, absolutely. Like, absolutely. That's
open. And you're like, I don't know if I belong here, but I belong here. It's a really great experience to have. You know, I think we're both very fortunate to have been a part of that. You know, when we've interviewed other people who've had that same experience, yeah, we're lucky.
Let's stop talking about them. Let's get right into the interview with them. So coming up next is our interview with Lorenzo Marco Savona.
The Lorenzo Marco Savona.
All right, our next guest here is Lorenzo Marco Savona. Lorenzo, the man, the myth, the legend. You've heard his name many times on this podcast leading up to it. Lorenzo's been a mentor to almost everybody that we've had on the show so far, and definitely including Fred and myself. I don't want to caress his ego any more than we have to at this point, but
there'll be plenty of time for that later.
Yes, we sure will. Lorenzo right now currently is a wine and food consultant at Portovino Consulting, and among many, many other things, but that's sort of the current role. But Lorenzo, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to see you again and have you on here and have you as part of the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be with you guys, even remotely. So yeah, fantastic.
As we sort of mentioned a little bit before, the whole premise of the show, we have the guest on and the guest kind of leads the content and has a beverage of choice and a food of choice. So we're going to have our beverage of choice, which I think we've already maybe participated in slightly here.
But, too much?
not too much yet, but hopefully by the end it'll be too much. Why don't we just get right into the wine part of it. Let's have a little cheers and talk about what we're drinking first. So cheers.
Mr. Savona, welcome.
Cheers.
Chin chin.
All right. So for those people that weren't able to drink with us right now, what do we got going on? What do we just drink on here?
Drinking probably one of my favorite white grape varietals, really underappreciated, which means it's a good value for the quality of wine. The grape is Chenin Blanc. It's most known in wine geek circles for as a Loire Valley grape and made into wonderful wines there. It's known probably not by grape name, but just it's been a blending grape in California for over a century because it's got high acidity. And even when it's overgrown, it has good sweetness and decent fruit. So they've blended it a lot in California table wines. You know, South Africa basically made most of their Planck white wines with Chenin Blanc as a base. It's one of the most widely planted grapes for whites. I think it's second only to Muscat. And the styles can be wildly varied. So I think we're all drinking a dry variety now. And for those of you who don't know what dry wine is when the glass is empty, it's dry. No.
Yes. Classic. Sorry. I clocked that at 2.5 minutes.
Yeah, you got the over. I think we set the line at 1:45.
Right.
Did I make the spread?
I don't know what the over under was. I'll get back to you. I didn't see you picking a French varietal, but correct me if I'm wrong, your love of wine, did it start in France? Am I remembering that correctly?
No. Okay. I mean, my wine life before I was aware of it was, you know, around the table with my family. My parents and my grandparents would go to New Hampshire for a packy run and get, you know, jug wine, you know, Cabari white and red or Gallo. And, you know, back in the 70s, yes, I am that old, back in the 70s, the jug wine was actually very good in California. It wasn't until probably the late 70s, early 80s that a lot of producers figured out that if you put it in a 750 and a cork in it, you could charge 4 or 5 times as much. So the jug wine was relegated to what was left, you know, in the tanks. So it got very bad. And, you know, we could tie Chenin into that because Chenin was, you know, used in a lot of those blends for the whites because it added acidity. And if you let it go long, it has great sweetness. But if you do overcrop it, you're going to get a big, flabby, uninteresting wine. So I think my wine craziness came, it probably started at L'Américaine, was my first restaurant job as a busboy. And I was working with Elena and Jean-Claude Jaza.
I remember and, that. Now. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Jean-Claude was not only my restaurant father, but, you know, kind of the beginning of the wine stuff. And the Saturday nights after service, he would pop up in some outrageously expensive wine, you know. So my first Sauternes, my first Grand Cru Burgundy. And I didn't fully appreciate it then. You know, I did it because it was cool and Jean-Claude was cool and I wanted it to be cool. But, you know, in terms of, you know, get back to what you said, Fred, my wine, let's just say that I became aware of what I wanted to do as a grown-up when I went to New York to the Winebow offices. Winebow is a big Italian importer. And we tasted 65 white wines on Friday afternoon and another 55 red wines on Saturday. But that white wine tasting, I could point to that and say, you know, after, you know, 64 white wines and, you know, just writing down, like, because it's just going. I mean, you're just tasting wine, tasting wine, tasting wine. And it was like, you know, okay, minerally, lemon, citrus, blah. And then, you know, like, and then they brought out a dessert wine or a sweet wine, as I prefer to call it. It was Malvasia de Lipari from Carlo Hahner, you know, from the Lipari Archipelago off the coast, northern coast of Sicily. And it was, I mean, it was a revelation. It was like, you know, and on the island, you know, so it tasted like mandarin, fig, and pine, and eucalyptus, and just like exploded. And you know, with sweet wines, sometimes you think, oh, it's sweet and it's going to be cloying, and this was sweet. And then the finish was just, it lingered, but it wasn't heavy. It was light. And then I found out on the island, they grow mandarins. They have pine, scrub pine. They have, you know, figs. All of what I tasted in that wine was in the bottle. And it, you know, that's what the French call terroir, you know, la terre, it's the life of the wine. And it's because, and that's what makes wine fascinating and why we all chase it, is because we want to know, okay, that's where it came from. And that's why it tastes like that. So Chenin Blanc.
Can I interrupt you real quick? How long ago, do you remember roughly how long ago that was, like timeline was? Not trying to make anybody feel old, but I'm just, you know, there's a point in your life when these things kind of spring, that's the moment in your life that's like lightning in the bottle. You know, and you could be in your teens, you could be in, and you're not supposed to be drinking, but whatever. Or you could kind of be in your late 30s, depending on how you find your way down this road, you know, because we know what this industry is like. You know, it's, if you're talented, you can make it happen, but the barrier to entry is low. And sometimes you just have to have somebody show you the way. So it sounds like Jean-Claude got you there, but then that tasting experience, and you remember everything about that taste. And to me, that's the moment. I feel like that's the moment. So if you could let us know. Oh, 15, 20.
No, no. I agree. I mean, that really kind of, the light went on and some bugs flew out of my ears. that was 1991. That was November of 1991.
Wow.
And yeah,
just a few years ago. Yeah.
Just a couple two tree. And then, you know, wine, because when you first get into wine, and tell me if I'm wrong, but when you first get into wine, it's daunting. It could just seem immense, you know. And so I realized that I needed to focus on one thing. So I focused on Italian wines. And, you know, I was blessed because the wine distributor that I was selling wine for had a great importer in Winebow that was bringing in really good Italian wines. And the rep, a guy named George Schwartz, saw something in me, some promise in me. And so that was November. The following March, I was on one of the famous Winebow wine marches of death, where you go, you taste in the morning, you have lunch and drink, taste in the afternoon, have dinner, have grappa, and then get up in the morning and do it again. Yeah. And so it's two wineries or three wineries a day, but it was fantastic. And so I realized that Italian wine was my entry, right? That was the door that opened. But then, you know, we opened the Zigomat in 94, and it was a French bistro. So, you know, then I had to kind of reorient myself to French wines, which isn't hard.
Yeah, that's not a bad thing to have to do.
No. And again, I was very lucky. I had great suppliers. They quickly you know, the stupid ones quickly got afraid of me.
Funny how it works like that, isn't it?
yeah. You know, I just knew what I liked, and I was young and naive enough to just tell them. So I was able to get the wines that I wanted. And even when I couldn't get the wines that I wanted, I, you know, infected people like Andrew Bishop with the idea of bringing Lambrusco into a market that supposedly didn't want Lambrusco. Mm-hmm. So he ended up being the first person to bring real Lambrusco into Massachusetts.
And delicious. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yes.
Property. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So, I mean, and that, you know, I lived in France too. I taught at university there in Normandy back in, that was 89. And I, you know, and I'd go to the wine shop and I'd get little village Bordeaux, you know, the Bergerac and I really enjoyed those, you know, for $9 or $10 a bottle. That helped me get through. I lived there again in, what was that, 90 for like 6 months. I lived in Paris. And so in Paris, that's where, you know, the Loire Valley wines kind of came in onto my radar, because that's what a lot of what the little bistros have is Loire Valley wines, because the Loire Valley is so close to Paris. And, you know, and you get those beautiful, you know, Loire Valley Cab Francs, those pretty light minerally Pinots for reds, and then you get Chenin Blanc and Sauvignon Blanc, just wonderful wines. But Shannon always has gotten me, because you could make a bone dry Shannon, like I think we're all drinking right now. Then you could get something that's a demi sec. And I wouldn't normally recommend demi sec Shannon from anywhere else except the Loire, because still, even with climate change, you're getting a nice bright acidity and you get that wonderful balance. So even a demi sec will still seem dry by comparison to other wines, you know. And then you get the moelleux, the sweet Chenins, the dessert, or and yeah. Sweet wines could go with anything. Sweet wines are wonderful with, you know, spicy foods like foie gras or chicken wings, like buffalo wings, you know, like a Chenin, a moelleux, you know, Chenin Blanc from the Loire with hot spicy buffalo wings.
Yeah, you know, I mean, who doesn't like sweet spicy together? Absolutely. I mean, it's a brilliant call. I think it is a lot more flexible than people want to think. And I think you touched on it earlier when you said, oh, people think it's going to be syrupy or cloy, and it's not when it's properly done. It kind of lips on the end. It's an intense wine up front, but if it's done right, you kind of know it when you taste it. And my joke is, nobody's ever walked up to you in your entire life and said, wow, that's the best underripe peach I've ever eaten. We want some of the sweet fruit. I mean, to be honest. So I'm glad you brought that up, because it's a gastronomic wine. You don't just have it as a nightcap, and there's nothing against port. I know people think of it in that same vein as port, and ports is as flexible, but it's not like it just has to be this thing you have randomly. You can actually enjoy it. You know, it's if you do it the right way, it's a little more. I don't know. You can be more open-minded, folks. I don't know. You're right.
I think what gets me going most about it is that it's a very adaptable white wine. So tonight I went to our little market here in Milton, and I got us some Amelia Loves Shumai. So I got some Shumai and some Maki and some spring rolls, you know, and they have the hot and sour, you know, the hot and sour stuff that goes with it, and the soy sauce, and it worked great for right. that. You know, I mean, it wasn't, yeah, I wasn't trying to match it. It just happened. It just, you know, the flavors are there, you know. And then, you know, the reason why I brought up Roviola is that for all the talk of cheese and wine, that there is a real, you know, it's not, you can't do every wine with every cheese, right. You know? And so with a washed rind cheese, like a Roviola, you can't have a big red wine. It would totally overpower it. It doesn't have enough fat to stand up to, you know, big red wine, you know, a lighter red, you know, like a Barbera or, you know, a Loire Valley Pinot or, but I think with the fruit profile of, you know, and this is from the Savoie. So it's not, this isn't from the Loire, it's from the Savoie. So the flavors tend to be, the acid tends to be a little higher. It tends to be more melon than apricot, but given that, and given the big flavors that Shannon has, it still works with the Roviola. You know, the Roviola, it helps you take another bite.
Yeah. So you you did the segue for me, which the cheese that I was just talking about was the food topic or the food item that we're talking about. So Roviola is actually my favorite cheese that I've ever had. And you know, I actually have a piece of it right next to me right now. It's one of the things that I carry at Spello at the restaurant. We do a bruschetta with Roviola and apples with a little vincotto on top. Roviola. So specifically, you talked about Roviola tre latte, which I used to be able to get tre latte in this country back when I was first starting out at Tommaso, when the three of us all started working together. I was able to get the tre latte. Lately, I've only been able to get the due latte. But maybe just touch on that a little bit, Lorenzo, and the difference between the, I mean, besides the obvious two and three part of it, but maybe touch a little bit more on Roviola in general and what that cheese is all about.
So I do have to give a shout out to my friend Matt Rubiner, who is one of the top cheese people in the world. Literally, he came in sixth in the World Cheese Master Championship in France in 2017, sixth in the world. So
pretty big, so
yeah,
kind of a
big deal. And he's in the Berkshires. He's got a wonderful store called Rubiner's Cheesemongers and Vine Grocers. And we just saw him a week and a half ago. So when we opened Ziegelmatt, I wanted to have a cheese plate. Excellent. And Matt had stopped working for the CIA and got a job with Fromager Kitchen in Cambridge to learn from the master. And he would bring us the cheeses for our cheese plate. As an aside, one day he brought some cheeses, and one of the cheeses was very ripe. It smelled like the diaper pail that some of us who have children have smelled. I had to make him come back and take it out of the restaurant because I couldn't serve patrons with that smell. Restaurant. So, I mean, I found Robbiola just as a matter of course going to Formaggio, and then Matt turned me on to Due Latte and Tre Latte. So Robbiola, if you just get a Robbiola, it's a cow's milk cheese. And so it's a young cheese. It's not aged. Anybody gonna see that?
Very nice.
So depending on the dairy, you know, whether they have goat's milk or sheep's milk, they'll add that in. And so the Tre Latte is cow, sheep, and goat. And it's not just that sweetness from the cow's milk, you know, it has a more earthy aspect to it, but not overwhelming. The cheese itself, even the Tre Latte, is a mild cheese. It's Amelia's favorite cheese, you know, and she does drive me crazy though, because she won't eat the skin.
So she leaves the good stuff in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. So Susan will scoop out the middle and just make me livid. You know, like I'm sitting there, are you crazy?
Yeah, it's nice to have that little foil to the texture, isn't it? I mean, yeah. Brighter crackers with it, but to have that little bit of rind is kind of nice. I like it.
Yeah, and it's you're supposed to eat it. It's made to be consumed. So, and also geographically, vis-a-vis the Chevigny that I have from the Jura, it's just over the hill. I mean, so the Savoie is in the French Alps, and then as you go over the hill, you go over the Alps into Italy through Val d'Aosta, you come to Piemonte, which is where the Robbiola comes from. So, I mean, in terms of wine and food pairing, I've always leaned on geography. Absolutely. You know, the wine from there is going to taste best with the food from there, because wine is an agricultural product. So, you know, in my family in Calabria, you know, they have a farm. And when my mom was growing up, you know, they didn't pick this grape, that grape, the other grape, they picked all the grapes. And my great grandmother would make this little rosé wine that's what they had. And it was just, that's it. That was their table wine. My uncle, now with the help of my grown cousins, makes a wonderful little table wine. And it's just a blend of grapes. It goes along with the soppressata that they make or the cheese that they have. And that's geography. But it's not geography. It's really farmers' moist knot. Right, you have it, you use it, you know, like grappa is made from the leftovers. So even the skins and the stems and the seeds, you know, they're going to make something out of it because you don't waste anything. The other thing is, you know, when I met Susan, I was at Tommaso. We just opened Panzano, and you know the business, we work late, so I would get out at, you know, if I was lucky, 9 o'clock, and I'd grab a bottle of a lighter red wine or a nice white wine, and I'd get a cheese and some bread, and she'd make a salad, and that's, we'd have dinner, right? I'd get to her apartment. The wonderful thing about it is, if you have taste, my COVID testing, I can smell.
Can you smell it?
I do it every Friday night. every Friday night.
Why just Friday? You want to be extra safe.
Well, you know what?
That's what we do it specifically.
Well, if you do it through the weekend and into Monday night, you're kind of covering most of the week. It's a real short span between the next test. It's safer for you. You're really being responsible. Seriously. I digress. Anyway, carry on.
No. We're all drinking. I think I'm drinking more wine. I know that I'm going to Bin Ends more. The point is that wine and food go well together, and it's not rocket science. People often say, "Oh, I don't know good wine." But listen, you go to Burger King instead of McDonald's, okay? Because you like Burger King burgers better. Right, you eat salmon and not hake because you like salmon better because it tastes better. You know what you like. So it's and it's the same thing with wine. If we can get past the idea that you have to be some sort of specialist to enjoy wine and just trust that we know what we like, right? If you know. What things taste like and you like what the way they taste, like you either like a cheeseburger or you want it without cheese, right? You want pasta with a white sauce or you want pasta with a red sauce. You like spicy, you don't like spicy, right? So
you mind if I use that as a segue real quick?
go for it.
I'm gonna step back just like a paragraph before, and I think when, by the way, Andrew is one who trained me at Les Zygomont. Thank you. We had a great conversation about that. I think he'd only been there for like 3 weeks, recently divorced and all that fun stuff. So that was an interesting training for me, but I loved it. But when I started there, I didn't know my elbow from my ass when it came to wine. And I grew up in Florida. We didn't have wine on the table. It just wasn't part of what my family did. So wine was very much a foreign idea to me. You were kind enough to let me come in and tend bar. I kind of understood spirits to some extent, and I got to learn at light speed. But what really struck me is what you just said. Do you enjoy it? Great. It was that. I mean, I had no idea it was like that, because the perception or the veneer that wine had at the time for me was like, oh, that's for people who are smarter and cooler and more intelligent than I am. Or I just said smarter twice. But anyway, that wasn't for me. You know what I mean? And you did an incredible job, not only with me, with the staff, but everybody who came in. And yes, it's part of hospitality, but either you have that gift or you don't, to where this is for you. Just try to enjoy it. We can help you out a little bit, but you're going to find your own way. But we're going to kind of give you that gentle little nudge. And that was unique at the time, because if I'm remembering correctly, it was very much a Francophile society in Boston at the time, which is not a bad thing. But there was a little bit of that, we're going to keep you at arm's length because we have the knowledge and you don't. And you were the exact opposite. I mean, it was literally anything goes. We're going to pour a Morgan by the glass. I've got this great little Saracen Pinot or Pinot Noir. I've got the Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand. Oh, I found this insane. What was the, not the Pasito, but Crocker? Do you remember that? Oh my God, mind blowing. I'll get to that in a minute. We've got a Sagrantino by the glass, and it was just an amazing experience, and everything was on the table. And it was a revelation, and that made me, well, quit my day job. And I've been doing this ever since because I loved it. I mean, there's a little more to it, but this isn't about me. But I think you hit a vital point, and you were the first person, and you're still amongst the few that really treat it like that. The industry has gotten better, but at the same time, it's gotten almost about being a beverage instead of about what you just talked about, spirit of terroir, spirit of hospitality, the spirit of enjoyment, and we're somewhere in the middle here. And I have to thank you, the few guests that we've had on, we're all here because of you. And I think the guy in the middle of the screen is also here because of you. I'm only guessing to some extent.
No, he's a very talented person.
Yeah, I know, just a little bit, right? But yeah, it was, I'm really glad I just wanted to drive that point home, because to me, that's the, I don't know why people get so flustered by it, because just enjoy it. When you're talking to the right person, you'll know, they're going to try to show you the right way and put the right thing in your hand, in your glass, whatever. And it's that simple. Yeah. Thank you. Cause you were literally the only one who treated people like that back.
Well, from my experience. It probably came from my, you know, because I came at it sideways. I mean, a lot of people in the wine business seem to come at it sideways. Yeah. I mean, there are a few people that wake up when they're five and say they want to be a wine dude or dudette.
Yeah, the ones that are born into it.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, even if you're I think if you're born into it, I think that's a handicap. I think that, you know, like if you're born into a family in Bordeaux or Burgundy or, you know, an area that's known for X, Y, or Z, then you're expected to do that. And it's harder to explore, I guess, because I don't know, maybe I'm, you know, because I'm a little ADD, you know, like most of us restaurant folks.
Squirrel.
Yes. Wine changes all the time. I mean, unfortunately now it's changing because of climate change, but there's that. I think because wine, it's still a bit that way in terms of, you know, what you said, Fred, there's still people that lord certain ideas over people, and they take the little knowledge that they have and they try to make it seem like you don't get it. I mean, orange wine is a perfect example.
Thank you.
I'm all for making wine with the best growing practices, the sustainable growing practices, and to let the wine become what it's going to become. But wine doesn't become what it's going to become without a winemaker intervening. It's impossible.
At some point, you're going to crush the grape, so you've intervened. And there's a million steps that can happen after that. But thank you for bringing that point up. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think that what happens now, you know, vis-a-vis natural wine or orange wine, is that people take that little bit of knowledge and they try to spin that into something, you know. And at the end of the day, if you can't drink it because it tastes bad, what's the point?
Yeah, I mean, it's really that simple. Right?
Well, do you mind if I share a little story I had?
Go for it.
I'm not going to name names, but I was sat on a natural wine panel for Portland Wine Week, which was like about 4 years ago. And at the time, it doesn't matter so much. But there was a group of us who got together. You know, there's suppliers and importers out there, and we kind of work together. And these are people who are really good at what they do. I feel like they've really thought about their portfolio. They're intelligent. They're good with people. They just know how they understand wine, and they're kind of fluid with it. And we all kind of we batted a bunch of ideas back and forth, and it's like, well, what do we mean by natural wine? What is that definition? And that was the whole idea behind this like little symposium we did. And I had a flashback to the thing we did in Nantucket when the guy talked about napalm and just flattening the vineyards, because it was that kind of it was almost like that kind of a disaster. When we looked out into the room, the moderator was great. There were four of us up there. And we all brought a wine to the table, and we got to try each person's wine. And we were talking about what we thought, and I kind of went at it from the point of biodynamic. I had a great Vernaccia from San Gimignano on the table. She's biodynamic. I mean, just minimal intervention, but just the wine is proper. It's balanced. It's good. I feel, you know, my opinion. And we were talking about it, and everybody had their own idea. And this person sitting next to me, who's pretty prominent and famous, said, well, you have to liken natural wine to New York street fashion. And I just, my face turned purple with rage, because it just, I'm looking out of the audience.
I can see that.
Of like 20 somethings to maybe early 30s, very impressionable people in the industry. And this was supposed to be a luminary sitting next to all of us. And it was just really disappointing to hear wine spoken about as fashion, because natural wine, I understand why people, I kind of understand that pendulum swing. You know, we all lived through the late 90s, early 2000s when more was more. And we've had this discussion before on the podcast, where it was just a lot of oak, oxygenation, and wines were just gigantic. You know, not everybody, but it was out there and it was kind of preferred. So you can see why things would come back. I'm like, look, let's just not mess with this thing. This is what nature gave us. This is the harvest. Let's do it. But there's a balance in the middle, and that's not fashionable. Taste change, climate changes. So that kind of skews the way you work and do things. But it just made me insane. And I don't have a problem with natural wine. I just have a problem with wine that's not well made. I've had natural wines that have been very good. I've had orange wines that have been very good. Few and far between, they're out there. But I've had unfortunately, many more disappointments because of what you said. It's like, maybe we're trying to be cool, or we're going to lord this over it. And like, no, this is how you do it. But Chef, you said it best. Like, I can't drink this sometimes. And I've unfortunately had a lot of those experiences. And I think that talent and somebody trying to do the very best they can and having the right terroir, the right vineyard sites, whatever you want to refer to it, matters almost more than anything. It's easy to make a really bad bottle of wine. It's almost impossible to make a great bottle of wine. And I guess that's my point. But I'm glad you brought up the whole orange wine thing, because I don't have a problem with that. I just don't like the fact that, you know, oh, this wine has some sulfites in it, you know, parts per billion. So that's not, you know, I can't put that in my body. Yet the same person will suck down a gallon of orange juice or eat cauliflower, which has thousands of times the sulfites in it naturally, which, you know, so I'm hoping for reasonability, because a lot of those people, like, it's the too cool for school kind of thing. And I don't like that. That's exactly what wasn't great about the wine industry when you were trying to change it, you know?
And well, I think the over manipulation of wine, like from a chef standpoint, when people are trying to over manipulate food, I feel like you lose a lot of the general natural characteristics of the food. And, you know, I mean, with Italian cooking and my style of cuisine, I just try to get the best ingredients and basically don't screw them up, you know? I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Get great ingredients, don't fuck them up, do the proper cooking techniques, and you're good. And I feel like the best wines come from that same philosophy and that same theory, which actually brings me to my next point here with a couple of new organic wines that we're starting to bring into the country that should be arriving shortly. So Lorenzo, can you talk a little bit about the Montepulciano and the Pecorino?
Sure. So, you know, wine, in terms of finding wine, for me, it could come from anywhere. So, you know, 10 years ago, I was on a train going back to Florence from a day trip in Venice, and me and the family were sitting with a family from California who had just been in Tuscany, and they met a winemaker in Greve who was making Chianti, and they said he was making organic wine, and he was putting in a Tetra Pak. And I nearly grabbed the guy by the shoulders and shook him and said, "Where is he?" Because my whole thing has been accessibility to wine, right? I mean, I love Grand Cru Burgundy. That's like, I would fall on my sword for Grand Cru Burgundy, because and because it's when it's right, it's like. However, day to day, you want a nice, quaffable wine, and you don't want to have to think about it's going to go bad, or and you know, up to that point, the only box wines that I'd had here in the States were made as a cheap alternative. You know, in other words, you know, oh, I could save money on the bottle and the cork and put my plonk in this and sell it for $15.
Yeah, which whereas, is exactly why box wine has had a bad reputation.
Right.
Yeah.
So Michael Schmelzer, this winemaker, was putting really good wine in Tetra Pak. You know, he was of the same mindset. He wanted to get good wine into people's hands and at a reasonable price. So that was that. And then, you know, a couple of years ago, I can't believe it's been 2 years already, my cousin's husband in Calabria said, you know, Lorenzo, I'm working with this winery. I represent them here in Calabria, and I'd like you to talk to him. He'd like to get into the States. So I started a conversation with this guy, Mario Marino della Fazia.
Irish guy, huh?
Yeah,
right. The Irish. Irish and German.
Right outside of Liverpool.
So we went back and forth, and he needed some help figuring out how to get the wine here, samples. So one day I went on the porch, and there was a box, you know, it was probably like a almost 3-foot by 3-foot cube from mailboxes, et cetera, in Abruzzi.
Spent $6,000 shipping that case of wine to you.
it was over $300.
Oh my God.
And he sent two of them, because I asked him for two bottles of each, you know, unfortunately there's corked wines and stuff. And the wines were good, but I'll just say this, and hopefully my Italian cousins will forgive me. But Southern Italy is probably like New Jersey. The wine tastes there tend towards the sweet. And so, you know, all of these wines were off dry and, but I could tell the fruit was really good. So I asked them to send me, you know, samples of, they were making box wine. I said, send me samples of the box wine. They were good. So I said, okay, we want this. We want it organic. So Mario is the president of a big cooperative. They have, I don't know, something crazy, like 300 hectares under vine.
Wow.
So they've got a lot of fruit and some of it is organic. So he shipped me samples of organic Montepulciano and Pecorino, and we decided on that. And this could have gone a little bit faster without COVID. I mean, without COVID, we probably would have gone there in February, March last year and just take it there, you know, get it done. But mm-hmm. we had to go back and forth. So we're going to do Montepulciano d'Abruzzo DOC in a 3-liter box. And the Pecorino is going to be IGT, both organic. And they're 3-liter boxes. Oh, that's the other thing. He didn't have 3-liter boxes. He was doing 5 and 10. Because
that's too big, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the Northern European market is almost exclusively box wine.
Yeah.
Now, because it's, you know, it's a lower carbon footprint. It's a good price, and you know, 5 liters is good for restaurant, but it's not really good for consumer. And we went through over design. So we came up with a design that looks like the plain cardboard with the name of the wine and then a sticker for Mies. And it's really terrific. And it's going to be here. Well, knock on wood. it should be in Chelsea, on the 15th.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
This is our good friend, David Mitchell, who runs a great importing company.
Yeah.
Lorenzo and David work hand in hand quite a bit, just to fill in the blanks there.
Yeah. Yeah. So David Mies will distribute the wines here in Massachusetts. And, you know, this cooperative, there's a lot of potential there. They make some really nice, inexpensive sparkling wines. Spumante, he's sending rosé samples of last vintage. We'll do a rosé bag in the box.
That's smart.
Yeah. I mean, bag in the box is terrific for everyday wine. You put it on the counter, you grab a glass, you're cooking something, you could take a couple ounces or whatever to deglaze. And, you know, that's part of the marketing for this will be to sell it to restaurants as a house wine and as a cooking wine. Because the price will be, I think if everything is right, it should be on the shelf at $15 or $16.
Yeah. And I have to say this right now, and I'm sorry for the interruption. Do not cook with wine you wouldn't drink. I don't know what cooking wine is.
I just finished a cooking class describing that entire thing. Just the whole bridging and cooking with something that you would otherwise drink. I literally just finished a cooking class, and I probably talked for 5 minutes straight about why I'm drinking the same wine that I'm cooking with. So it's certainly in the restaurants in the past. And a lot of that has come from, you know, people like Fred and Lorenzo, teaching me throughout the years about wine. And I mean, when I started, I didn't know anything about wine when I started in the kitchens. And, you know, I've certainly have a long way to go, but a lot of that knowledge definitely comes from certainly Lorenzo. And obviously, I deal with Fred every day, so.
Well, I learned it by watching Lorenzo.
Oh, shit, that was you?
Gen Xer or prior out there, you'll remember that horrible commercial, which is absolutely still hilarious to this day. So, hey, real quick before we move on from it. So I know people, there's still a bit of a stigma, and Screw Caps or Stelvin suffers from this too, that people think it's poor quality wine in the boxes. That's not the case anymore. Other than, you know, the packaging being less expensive, what is the benefit to having a box wine? And pro tip, by the way, I strongly recommend you pour your wine into a vessel, because if you're drinking out of a box wine, it's really easy to drink way too much wine. You need to measure yourself. Anyway, I should let you answer the question.
Those are called box stands, Fred. I've been there.
We've all been there, which is why I brought it.
Well, when it's at the end of the box, How are you going to get that those last drops out?
Yeah, that's the only way to do it.
Box stand. that's my injury. I can't play today.
I've got box.
I'm doing box stands. So, I mean, in terms of advantages, I mean, there's feel good stuff. Like it's a much smaller carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're done with it, the box breaks down and goes into recycling. And, you know, when it's good wine, it's something, you know, to Justin's point and to your point, to cook with that you're going to have, right. You know, we made a sauce yesterday, Susan and I, for meatballs, and you know, I deglazed with the white wine that we had with dinner. In terms of the flavors coming through of the wine, or you know, matching exactly it, in a sauce, it's not that important. But if you use a corked wine or you use a you know a nasty wine, those flavors are going to come through, and they're going to ruin your sauce. Yeah, and you know, box wines are great for couples or for singles that, you know, they want to have wine, but they're afraid to open a bottle because it's going to go bad, right? Because
yeah, you only have a few
the
days.
Average, you know, box wines, the bag collapses around the wine. There's no air that touches the wine that your last glass is going to be as delicious as the first glass.
And what's the lifespan once you've done that? Are you looking at about 30 days roughly on that? Maybe
no, gosh, no.
Definite, right?
Is it indefinite?
It well.
No, you know what? I'm sorry.
How do you guys drink wine? My God. I mean, it's like 2 days, right?
I'm on my third bottle today.
So you have plenty of time to work through it, right? So don't be intimidated by buying this 3-liter because you have plenty of time. You've got at least two, 3 months, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've done the work with the boxes. You know, because I have other things.
You've done the heavy lifting. You have time heavy.
5-liter boxes. No, I had a box wine. I don't know, 4 months, 5 months.
That's amazing.
You know, I mean, obviously, if it's summertime and you don't have central air, you know, you want to take some care and put it in the fridge. You know, the red and the white. There's nothing like having a chilled red from the fridge in the summertime, you know, and I'm not talking about putting a big old California Cab or Zinfandel in the fridge. I'm talking about your everyday reds. Yeah. And you know, I do have to put something in here for why I'm such a big fan of everyday wines, because when I did my year abroad in Florence, there was a little Chianti Puto. Chianti Puto is a sub region of Chianti. So it's got the little cherub. If you look at the necker, it's got a little cherub. That's the sign of the, not the big black cock of the Gallonero.
I think they call it Gallonero, but I'll just throw it out there.
Yeah, they can't call it Gallonero because Gallo sued them.
Oh, I know. Isn't that ridiculous? I can't even. Yeah.
So big black cock works better, I guess.
Jesus Christ.
Gets your attention.
Oh man, this is wandering off the rails.
So we would go around the corner. We'd go to the bakery, and the nice ladies would give us a day old bread, you know. And then we'd go to the Chianti Puto guy, and he had huge. They must have been 50 hectoliter demijohns, you know, those big ceramic demijohns. And he'd pull the and they had olive oil on top to keep the wine from oxidizing, and he'd stick it's like straw, like from like a straw bale, and stick it in and move the straw aside to get the siphon in, and he'd fill up our wine bottles for $1, you know. And you know, that was our everyday wine. And you know, it's you probably don't find it as much today, but it, you know, used to be that the people in town would go and fill up whatever container they had to get their everyday wine, you know, because again, it's an agricultural product. It's something that you consume every day. With your meal, it just goes. It's hand in hand. So, you know, the bag and box is a more what's the word I'm looking for? It's an easier it's an easier thing to sell. You know, you don't have to drive around in your truck in your big demijohn and, you know, right, siphon out wine for people. but if you put four bottles of wine in your fridge, it takes up a lot of room.
Yeah.
If you put a 3-liter box, which is about like if you close a 15-inch laptop and make a cube, that's about a 3-liter bag of box.
It doesn't take up much space at all. It maybe takes up the space of like 2 regular wine bottles when it's all said and done.
Yeah.
It's and you much can put, more, it, it's put stuff more on top of it. Most people's lifestyle. And it's nice to be, just to have, like, even if you don't want to have a full glass, have a half glass of the wine on Tuesday, then on Sunday you can have the same wine and cook with it and have maybe more focused experience with the wine. But you're right. I mean, table wine, I don't think is fair. I think everyday wine is better. I think when you say table wine, people kind of think, good everyday wine. That's a harder thing to achieve than I think making really great cru wine sometimes, because it's got to be broad appeal and it's got to be balanced and people need to like it and they need to come back for more. And I feel like it's a harder mark to hit sometimes. I know that seems like a weird way to look at it, but I feel like, you know, because our bread and butter when we were running the shop was between $10 and $15. If you let somebody down in that category, you don't get them back, you know? Anyway.
Well, I don't know if you remember when we were opening Tommaso and we were looking for the house wine.
Yep.
Reds were easy to find, you know, inexpensive reds that were good. Table wines, good everyday wines. Those are easy to find. A white wine, because there's not a lot of places to hide in a white wine. And part of it is because it doesn't have skin contact. You don't have that little extra dimension to it that red wine does. So I think you hit a really good point, Fred, because to get that everyday wine and hit that price point, it's tough. I mean, listen, if you think about it, you know, you have a glass bottle with a cork and a capsule and a label. That's minimum $1.50.
Exactly.
$1.50.
You got to put it into a box and ship it.
Yeah. You know, a roll of material that would be made into Tetra Paks would fit in half of a tractor trailer. And that roll of material for the Tetra Paks would make 3 tractor trailers worth of, in terms of bottled wine, you know?
Yeah, the project you're working on, you're getting a higher quality wine than most typical cooperatives. You're getting it at a lower price because you don't have to pay for as much packaging. Shipping's less. I mean, I brought in box wine too when I had my gig where I decided I needed to lose thousands of dollars every year. but we brought that in. It was easier to ship. You know, ours was 5-liter, which wasn't quite the right size, but it was still pretty popular. But you've got a very good bottle of wine, but it's a box. It'll last for months and you've got a good option for red and white. And so you kind of cover all the bases and you can still get most of your fridge back and you can have it on a daily basis. And having a glass of wine with dinner, 2, in my case, sometimes 4, is totally healthy. I just wanted to walk people through that. I think it's important for them to get out of that context of, like, you know, just because the packaging's different doesn't mean it's, you know, low quality. Like screw caps, Stelvins have really, I think, finally overcome that, but that took a long time to get there. And I think box wine is getting there at light speed. And, you know, you get more bang for your buck. I mean, who doesn't, that's appealing to everybody. Yeah.
And you don't have to go out as much, especially like during COVID,
right?
Sales of bag and box wines went up 30%.
Yep.
Because you had to make fewer trips to the store for wine because everything else
and it's going to taste
my wine.
I promise you folks, it tastes a million times better than canned wine. Sorry, just being honest. Anyway, Justin,
that Montepulciano and the Pecorino, are those both from Cantina San Giacomo?
Yeah, Cantina San Giacomo in Abruzzi. They're near Chieti. So if you're looking at the boot of Italy and you find Rome on the west coast, you could go almost directly across to East Coast and you'll be in Abruzzi, and Chieti is maybe, you know, 5 miles from the Ionian, the Adriatic over there. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, take a look. David's going to have those. We've had David on the show before. Meesewines.com. You see his portfolio on there. If you're in Massachusetts and you're lucky enough to be able to source some of his wines, check those out. Meesewines.com. But otherwise, I definitely recommend finding your local wine shop and talking to the people that are bringing in the wines and start exploring this bag in a box wine that, you know, can be that everyday table wine that you want to drink, that you can also cook with, that can also be part of your, you know, daily regimen of alcohol consumption.
Yeah. And you know what, folks, don't be afraid to move away from the big brands you see all the time. It's okay to go explore. Justin brought up the point. If you're talking to somebody who works at the store, they're going to do their best to point you in the right direction and make other suggestions for you.
Oh yeah. I mean,
be afraid of the new. Embrace it.
Yeah. I think that, and I've said this many times over the years, find a good wine shop. It's like, you know, the butcher that our parents or our grandparents used to go to get that cut of meat that they, you know, and it might've been the off cut, right? But they wanted it. And so going to a wine shop and talking to somebody there, and listen, people don't work in wine shops to make money. They work in wine shops because they love wine. And if they really do love wine, they're going to listen to you and they're going to try and find that wine that makes you happy, because then you'll come back.
Yep.
So, you know, Fred said it best, take advantage of the wine shop folks. They're going to, you know, we could talk about all the different wines in the world, but if you're not here or there or the other place, your shop's going to have different things. So trust your shop.
Yes, absolutely. Well, with that, I think we'll wrap it up, and just want to say thank you once again, Lorenzo, for joining us. It's always always a pleasure to hang out and chat with you. And
we could go on
for hours and hours at this point, but yeah, we
wrap it up here. But people still listen to 4-hour podcasts, don't
they? Sure. Yeah, the ones that Joe Rogan is part of.
Right.
Exactly.
Call it the Gone with the Wind episodes. With an intermezzo in the middle.
Right. But again, thanks for joining us, and one last cheers, and we'll hopefully have you on again soon. And
yeah,
always a pleasure.
Yeah. Oh man, it was so nice to see you guys.
Yeah, it was really great catching up. Thanks for your time, and thank you for giving me the wine bug years and years and years ago. It's been a really great ride. Thank you very much. It's
the wine curse.
I owe you big time.
Okay, that was our interview with Lorenzo Marco Savona. He always likes to put his middle name in there to make sure that he's extra Italian.
Just don't want you to get confused.
Lorenzo, obviously, as we talked about during the interview, has always been a mentor to myself and to Fred. He was kind of the first guy that got me into the wine world. And Fred mentioned he was the first guy that got him into the wine world, too. And, you know, just having that. Anytime is always a good time, but then when you can get him rolling on wine and food and, you know, the things that he's really passionate about, with that, you know, that infectious laugh that he has, there's not too many people like him. Actually, I don't think there's anybody quite like him.
No, he's a one-off. Absolutely.
Yes. In the best way possible.
Yep.
But that laugh and some of the stories we started to get into reminded me of the Nantucket Wine Festival that that we all went down to. So the Nantucket Wine Festival is this big wine festival on Nantucket that has a lot of following. It's sort of a big deal.
Yeah, well, there's hundreds of chefs, hundreds of wineries there. It's just a mass of food and wine, and it was started out as a one-day event, and I think it starts Wednesday.
It's almost a week long.
Not a weekend anymore. Yeah,
which is funny because I lived on Martha's Vineyard for 5 years, and the only time I ever went to Nantucket was 5 years before that when we went to the Nantucket.
I didn't know that. That's funny. Yeah.
But I was one of the featured chefs during this Nantucket Wine Festival that we went to. And Fred and Lorenzo, and we all brought our significant others, my wife Emily, and Fred's wife Heather, and Lorenzo's wife Susan. The six of us went down, and they put us up in this little cabin. But the whole story, the whole night was just like a bunch of children at night camp.
Right. We were under this huge tent, right? And so you did a cooking, you were doing a cooking demonstration, and then you came back after telling everybody about it, or like a cooking class. Lorenzo sat on a luminary panel. And then we were like, we had our own table and we decided to do Brazzala. Am I right?
I brought all my cured meat. So all the meats that I cured at the restaurant, I brought a bunch down and we had a slicer and
the world's smallest slicer.
Yeah, it was the world's smallest slicer. And somehow Fred was the one who had to do all
the slicing meat for like 20 hours. It was ridiculous. I had a meat belt from all the shavings.
Yeah.
From the slicer. But we were eating and kind of drinking all day. And then when things wrapped up, there's a big roast at the end of the night, right? Big pig roast, which is the Nantucket Wine Festival is famous for this. You and I weaseled our way to the front of the line because we wanted the pig's ears and we got fucking skunked. Yes. They came out no ears.
No ears. It was an earless pig.
But yeah.
But yeah, so that I vividly remember after all of that stuff, we had been drinking wine all day on the boat, on the, you know. We were a bit tipsy.
Yeah.
we had lunch. We had pizza. You know, we went out for pizza.
Blood
orange San Pellegrino that
you can only get. I've never had this before. That's right.
it was a long day of, it was a long, great day. We had a lot of fun. But I just remember walking down the street at the end of the night, and it was like a bunch of school kids just laughing at the most ridiculous. I mean, nothing was even funny, but
it was stupidity. We were just laughing for the sake of laughing. And then it got worse. The harder somebody would laugh, the harder I would laugh. And then Lorenzo's laugh is so infectious. He would laugh harder. And like, I couldn't breathe at some point. I had to sit down on the sidewalk because I couldn't catch my breath. And then we got back to the room because we had to share the room for some reason. It was a
little cabin that they put us up in. Yeah. So there was sort of like the master bedroom, which was downstairs. And then, oh, you know what? Heather wasn't actually there. You were there.
No, I didn't want to correct you. No, it was just me. I was absolutely the fifth wheel.
So then we had upstairs, there was the little loft and it had two beds and my wife and I were in one and you were in the other and Lorenzo was downstairs, but it was all open air. And the whole night we're just
childish jokes. I think you brought up the blood orange thing and you just, like you said, I've never had this before in my life. And then the whole place lost it for like 10 minutes. And
it was just this ridiculous. And again, it's that infectious laughter that Lorenzo brings.
You know, that's a bit of a rambling story for everybody, but it's such a great memory. But I think the point being is, you know, that's Lorenzo. That's the experience we got to have because he's just open like that. I mean, a gifted wine mind, really great restaurateur. He's been a luminary for a lot of people in the industry, and he really helped change the attitude, the perception, and the way people saw food and wine. It was a revelation. And today it seems normal for, you know, a wine list to be really flexible, unique, and open, and you get a taste of this, you get a taste of that. It was not like that back then. It was completely unique. And it was even a rarity in places like San Francisco and New York. So he was a trailblazer, and he's the most down-to-earth, lovely human being. And it was just, you know, that story is a perfect example of who he is. I swear to God, he could hang out with anybody and have a good time.
You know, yes, like for that. Sure.
Yeah.
It just draws you to him. And, you know, he's always been a great mentor of mine and a great mentor of yours. So if anybody wants to follow him on Instagram, he is at Lorenzo Savona, S-A-V-O-N-A, at Lorenzo Savona is his Instagram handle. And
he's got good posts and some of the upcoming projects. See a little bit of a sneak preview of the stuff we talked about earlier. So definitely worth following.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. So if you're not familiar with Lorenzo, I would definitely, I mean, his name has come up in almost every podcast that we've had.
Come up in every podcast
so far. And that's not by accident, or, you know, that's just.
And he's not paying us. He's not paying us a penny, just so everybody knows.
No, not even a little. Anyway, go ahead and follow at Lorenzo Savona. And then as always, follow us on Instagram. Fred is at FMIV. And then I am at Chef Melnick. So you can follow both of us separately there, but you can also follow at culinary.rd at culinary road. So you can follow all three of us on there, two of us separately and one of us together.
All together.
And then also YouTube. Fred has a wine channel on YouTube called Until Next Wine with Fred Mullins. That's definitely a great place to check out some of the upcoming wine stuff that Fred has going on. So if you haven't seen Fred on Until Next Wine, I would definitely highly recommend it. It's a great resource. So go ahead and follow us on anchor.fm/culinary road. And if you want to leave a message on there, go ahead and click the message box and you can leave us a voicemail and we can start answering your voicemails as we go through these segments. And, you know, if you have a different topic or something else you want to talk to us about, leave it on there on anchor.fm/culinaryrd, Culinary Road. But also make sure you're following us on Spotify, Apple Podcast, rate, subscribe, follow, make sure that you are supporting us on the other end so that we can keep doing this podcast.
Keep going. And if you like it, share it, share the heck out of it.
That's it. I guess that wraps up this episode of Culinary Road.
Yeah, I guess on to the next fork in the road, right?
Absolutely. So,
like that one? Did you see what I did there?
Yeah, that was pretty good. All right, so we'll see you next week.
Ciao, everyone.